notes to later, William Stevenson writes as follows in the Borman Brotherhood. The grandfather clock bonged. Tea was brought and sponge cake. The gray fox, a very common nickname for Galen here, the gray fox droned on. Willy Brandt's Eastern policy had been plotted secretly a meeting in Rome between West German socialists and Italian communists. Galen, I found out later, repeated this accusation in his memoirs with no other documentation than unnamed intelligence sources. No wonder Gray Fox's own political supporters wanted him to keep quiet. He could say unblinkingly that the Secret Service should be used to fight Willy Brandt, appeasement, communism, in fact everything that did not accord with his right-wing friends. It never occurred to him that a new generation of Germans might be put off by his authoritarian views. If this sounds like an abuse of hospitality, I can only say that General Galen is a specimen worthy of study in the way the previous resident in that place by the lake, Freak, considered some condemned prisoners warranted closer examination. Interrupting here, this is a very interesting passage that Stevenson has. Basically, in comparing, by the way, Freak, Galen, I should say, lived in Freak's former house on Lake Starnberg. And what he's really saying here in the passage is that Galen should have had his head cut off and preserved in embalming fluid for further study. Repeating that last paragraph again. If this sounds like an abuse of hospitality, I can only say that General Galen is a specimen worthy of study in the way the previous resident in that place by the lake, Freak, considered some condemned prisoners warranted closer examination. When Freak was Reich Minister of the Interior and Gray Fox was shadowboxing the Bolsheviks, this order went out. The war against the Bolsheviks offers an opportunity of overcoming the shortage of skulls for the Heredity Research Center. The Jewish Bolshevik commissars, embodying as they do a revolting but characteristic example of subhumanity, give us the opportunity. After the Jew has been done to death, whereby the head must not be damaged, the officer should sever the head from the body and dispatch it in preserving fluid. It may be bad, returning here to Stevenson's account, it may be bad form to recall these things while taking tea and sponge cake with a general who boasts that as Secret Service chief, he knew all about practically everything, and then adds, without visible embarrassment, that naturally his work did not concern itself with the bestial manifestations of Nazi security work. But Gray Fox was the kind of man who would never, ever understand the effect upon ordinary people of what he was saying or what he had done. Not openly.
Okay, continuing on with a few more observations from William Stevenson. Again, reading from the Borman Brotherhood, he says, a curious habit of General Galen, I noticed, was that he copied one's gestures. It was unnerving at first, and then, perhaps, revealing. I would lean to one side of the chair and fold my arms, and so would he. If, in talking, I lifted a hand to make a point, his hand went up in response. He was, it seemed, fit as a fiddle, not uneasy, not uncomfortable, as elderly people sometimes are, because they try to cover up some infirmity. Pouring a drink, his hand was steady, so it was just a curious habit. His hand twitching his ear, when my hand twitched mine. Moving along, and back to Galen's conversation, Stevenson reports, Galen's real criticism of Hitler was that he lost the war because he ignored professional advice. Galen remained philosophically a Nazi, though, like all army officers, he did not join the Nazi Party. Skipping on down. I knew now, writes Stevenson, why Galen disturbed me and aroused the most profound sense of outrage. He had never fired a gun in anger, but his room was hung with photographs of himself on the firing range, arms outstretched, with pistol cocked, the stereotype of the figures one associates with the Nazi period, in ankle-length leather coat of black, and black peaked cap.
Well, one more detail here that we're going to provide concerning Galen's personal life is basically what he did after his supposed retirement from the BND, from his formal involvement with intelligence work, at least in as much as he would let on. Back to Spy of the Century by Cookridge. And keep in mind, this book was written in 1971. Today, on the threshold of 70 years, General Reinhard Galen has found a surprising new field of activities. He has become an evangelist, With still unimpaired energy, he has taken over the direction of a campaign for building new churches and schools for the Evangelical Church in Catholic Bavaria. After a life of seclusion, he frequently attends meetings all over the province at which appeals for new funds are launched. On occasion, he does not disdain to visit members of his religious community in order to encourage the enterprise and to pass the begging bowl. This shows both determination and courage, for in some of the rural districts of proverbially papist Bavaria, one conducts such campaigns at one's peril. It's worth noting that the last 5 or 6 years have seen the rise of what has been termed by the press the religious right, and the organizations such as Moral Majority and so forth, and it's at least worth speculating here in perhaps a somewhat light vein that if Reinhard Gehlen's Eastern Front Intelligence Organization was called Foreign Armies East, perhaps the Moral Majority is Foreign Armies West. And in a not-so-light vein, I think it's worth noting here that the connections of Reinhard Gehlen to religious institutions are certainly not limited to Protestant organizations, and the fact that he was doing his evangelical church work in Catholic Bavaria would not have proved dangerous to him and in apparently a very dogmatically Catholic Bavaria. That's not surprising in light of the fact that, as we're going to see in a future Radio Free America broadcast, Reinhard Gehlen received a very high award, specifically the Gran Crocito al Merito, from an organization called the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, or the Knights of Malta. That basically is the military arm, the lay military arm of the church, and Reinhard Gehlen received that church's highest award, only the fourth man in the 1,000-year history of that organization, dating back to the Crusades, to do so. And so maybe his seeming impunity in promoting Protestantism in Catholic Bavaria is not as surprising as you might think.
Indeed, and it's not that far away around that circle, because if there's anything that the evangelical religious right in this country and the religious right of the Catholic Church is personified in the Sovereign Military Order of Malta have in common, it's a very strong belief in the propaganda value of a quote-unquote heavenly injunction against communism, and a willingness to a religious resolution to go into a shooting war if necessary to keep Bolshevism from spreading across the world, et cetera. So something anyway to think about, perhaps, and something to leave you with. We're going to take a short break before coming back for phone calls. The number here is going to be 415-941-2500.
Any questions that you have, don't hesitate to bombard us here, because this is by no means all of the stuff that we have on Reinhard Gehlen. We thought we'd just throw out some of the main aspects of the Gehlen organization, because we're going to be coming back to Gehlen again and again. He figured very prominently in the assassination of President Kennedy, in the recent shooting of Pope John Paul II, and in many other organizations. So we're going to touch back on the Gehlen base time and again. So, there's a lot of material left uncovered here. Don't hesitate to ask us about it.
Indeed. And also, since we had so little time for phone calls on the previous Radio Free Americas, please feel free to bring up anything that you might have had left over from those broadcasts. Anyway, once again, I guess we can sort of leave on that note of Reinhard Gehlen in his black leather German army jacket and black leather peaked cap, out there handing out pamphlets for Christ, and a bulwark against the Bolshevists. And this is Nip Tuck. Dave Emery and myself will be right back with the next segment and your phone calls at 415-941-2500 of Radio Free America. Mentioning again, coming up in July, on July 8th and 15th specifically, is going to be a re-airing of Dave's and my production of The Guns of November, which was originally aired in the 4 weeks of November of last year. And that is going to be July 8th, 3 p.m. to 9 p.m., and July 15th, 3 p.m. to 10 p.m. So, specifically, just the information we've cut out, musical breaks, et cetera, as much as possible to render it down as economically as we can and save you folks some money on oxide. Once again, July 8th, 3 p.m. to 9 p.m., and July 15th, 3 p.m. to 10 p.m.
And you're going to hear more about the Gehlen organization on the Guns of November, because basically that organization was very much involved with the assassination of President Kennedy. While we're waiting for the lines to fill up here, 415-941-2500, I'll tell you about a couple of other pieces of information that we're going to get to in future shows, future Radio Free America shows that will involve the Galen organization. Now, we took a look at Valerian Trifa's connections to Richard Nixon, also the Trifa von Bolschwing connection. It's worth noting that a BND agent named Hans Langemann was engaged not only in deep-sixing some CIA information, which would have documented the Nazi connections of former Nazi Chancellor Kurt Kiesinger, which we looked at in the second of the Radio Free America broadcasts, but was also involved with, among other things, getting an agent of influence close to then-President Richard Nixon. Now, this is not when he was vice president, when he recruited, he tapped Valerian Trifa to give the opening prayer before the U.S. Senate. This is when he was president, and that agent of influence, recruited by Langemann, was described as a prominent Bay Area Republican. Also, Hans Langemann eventually became chief of security for the 1972 Olympics in Munich, Germany, which, of course, were victimized by terrorists linked by many to, among others, Muammar Gaddafi, whose Secret Service was put together by Galen. And that man, Hans Langemann, that information, by the way, from two articles from the New York Times on March 8th of 1982 and also March 19th. Of 1980, or March 9th, I believe it was, of 1982, and March 19th of 1982. And research credit for both of those go also to Mae Brussel. And interestingly enough, Hans Langemann also ran a BND spy ring inside of the Vatican for a time in the 1960s. That information from a book called O Vatican, recently published, and that authored by New York Times correspondent Paul Hoffman. Okay, a couple of other bits that we're going to be getting to about Galen in the future.
And one last interesting thing that, again, no information at this point on, but rather interesting that BND agent Longeman's agent of influence was apparently recruited from prominent Bay Area Republicans at much the same time as Otto von Bolschwing, a Galen connection, and through him connected to the BND, was in fact prominent in business and making contacts with political leaders in the Bay Area at that time. So maybe something to look forward to as far as research goes. Okay, going to the phones now, and the first call appears to be long distance. We're going to take it for that reason first, and it's from Murphy's. Good evening, and welcome to Radio Free America.
Hi.
Hello.
I want you to know we just really, really appreciate your program.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, how far away is Murphy's from here?
About 153 miles.
My goodness. Well, we're getting a good signal tonight. Well, glad we could have you with us.
Okay, I want to recommend a book that let everybody know that this didn't start with the end of the war. It was the preliminary. The groundwork for all this was laid prior to the war with the German-American Bund and all kinds of goodies that they had going here in the United States. And I'd like to recommend a book called Undercover, by John Roy Carlson, published by E.P. Dutton in 1943. And the subtitle on that is My 4 Years in the Nazi Underworld of America, the amazing revelation of how the Axis agents and our enemies within are now plotting to destroy the United States.
And it's a fascinating book. Dave and I both have copies at home. I think we've even used them from time to time. It's a hard book to find.
Uh-huh.
By the way, John Roy Carlson is actually the pen name. His real name was Arthur Derunian, D-E-R-O-U-N-I-A-N. He was an undercover FBI informant who was actually acting on assignment for the FBI to infiltrate the Nazi sympathetic network in this country.
It's a fascinating book, and if we know that this started before, then it's not quite, you know, as shocking. We know they've been working all the time.
Right, certainly, and making a lot of contacts with groups like William Dudley Pelley Silver Shirts and other groups of that sort within the United States. Very true, and a good point.
I want to thank you guys an awful lot, because I had the feeling that we lost the war, but nobody told us.
Well, you know,
the right, Germans won. You know, we didn't win.
There's a joke.
It all fell into place with listening to you.
There's a joke which was very popular during the Nixon administration, which would also apply equally well, I think, during the Reagan administration, because the same officials have been employed. But the joke went something like, well, it's a good thing that we didn't lose World War II, otherwise all our officials would be named Schultz, Weinberger, Kissinger, and Ruckels.
Oh,
in Ruckelshaus.
You did it.
And everybody be driving Japanese and German cars.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much for your
Take
call.
Take care of yourself.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And before the end of the broadcast tonight, we will, as we mentioned, Undercover, under the pen name John Roy Carlson, is a hard book to find. We will, before the end of the show tonight, to give you a chance to get pen and paper, mention at least one place where you may have a good chance of tracking that book down. So grab something to write with, and we will provide that information. Anyway, we do have a line open at 415-941-2500. Good evening, Palo Alto, and welcome to KFJC and Radio Free America.
Hi.
Hello.
I was kind of interested to hear you maybe expand a little bit more on the Syrian and PLO thing. One of the things I was just really confused by is it seemed to me certainly in the last few years when I have become politically aware, they have always been the communist linked, you know, very strongly. All their weapons come from Russia and things like that. Maybe also you might have a comment or two on the recent troubles in the PLO with sort of their, civil war, and whereas all the troops aren't really so loyal to Yasser Arafat.
Right, right. Okay. Do you want to take those on the air or off the air?
Oh, sure, on the air would be fine. But yeah, it's just something I'm sort of confused about. It's probably a whole other program, at least.
It practically could be. And one of the things, actually, that on this same subject that's quite interesting is that we had read some material from... I believe it was Alexander Coburn in the Village Voice. He had put together a column quoting such people as Albert Einstein and Hannah Arendt, both very well known, talking about the background of Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, and in fact their early links to fascism. And in part, a lot of this can be explained in the fact that both the Israelis and the Arabs originally made many of their contacts with fascism because that was one of the best ways and the easiest ways to get help against Britain in the Middle East. And so that's the genesis of a lot of these things. Now, as far as the later contacts with communism, a lot of the PLO stuff, especially their weaponry, as far as I can tell, and I'm not an expert on it, but as far as I can tell, it comes in second and third hand from a lot of other countries, a lot of other Arab countries, and partially because for so long the U.S. has been the champion of Israel in the Middle East. That's where Israel gets, you know, most of their defense materials from. A lot of the Arab countries get their defense materials and have for a long time from the Soviet Union, although they also do from the United States. So, for one reason, the PLO has been largely supplying themselves with the cast-offs or the black market weaponry from countries that are getting their weapons, you know, above the counter from communist countries.
Is the caller still on the line?
Yes.
Okay, caller, let me... ask you a question about your second question first and then get into a little bit of the substance from your first. When you were out talking about the divisions within the PLO, were you, in essence, sort of behind the scenes, sort of asking, are those divisions in any way affiliated with alternate, say, Western or right-wing and left-wing elements within PLO? In other words, say, Nazi or CIA-affiliated PLO links and Soviet-affiliated links?
Well, that did seem to me to be certainly possible from the way you're talking, especially if there was a very strong Nazi influence in the beginning of the organization of the PLO when, say, Yasser Arafat and many of his generals, if you will, were trained and whatever. And it seemed that many of these rebels now were sort of the younger fighters for them. And you know, how are they influenced? I really don't know that much about it. And I was just curious how much, you know, you could tell me in a few minutes.
Well, the PLO, yeah, again, in a few minutes, I don't know. The PLO is a very complex organization it's an umbrella organization, and many of its components have links to some to the Soviet bloc, some to the far right. A fellow by the name of George Habash heads up an organization called the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. That has many links to the far right, including CIA. I don't know as the specific current divisions within the PLO or something, because I thought that might have been what you were driving at. I don't know as that's something that at least I could comment on with any degree of authoritativeness. A sister station which does cover PLO affairs to some extent is KPFA, which I'm sure you could probably get 94.1. They frequently have interviews with PLO people who could talk about PLO dynamics a little better than I could. But going back to your question about the the early connections of the PLO and Palestine nationalism with the Third Reich. The main name you want to know here is somebody we're going to get to in our discussion of the Olympics massacre, is a guy named Haji Amin al-Husseini, who was not only the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and the chief leader of Palestinian Muslims, but he was as such the spiritual leader of all Palestinian Muslims, but is also was a major in the SS. Now, one of his proteges was a guy named Hassan Salome, who took commando training for the Third Reich and was involved in a diversionary organization, diversionary operation, I should say, during the Battle of the Bulge, which was to basically poison the wells of Tel Aviv to start an Arab uprising against the British, thereby diverting British forces away from the planned Nazi offensive in the Ardennes. And his son, Ali Hassan Salome, was the guy who led the Olympics massacre, and within about a year and a half of leading the Olympics massacre, he was working for the CIA in order to protect American military and diplomatic personnel from attacks by the various Palestinian organizations, which in and of itself is an indication of some of the divisions within that organization. But Haji Amin al-Husseini is the main name you want to know there, and in a Hard Rain broadcast, it'll be coming up, hopefully this coming Sunday, if we can get everything on the air, a synopsis of a recent series that's been done on Hard Rain. We'll talk about some of these links. But there's one name you want to know about right off the bat.
Anyway, just one last kind of summing up, again, to return to the earlier point. One of the problems with the Middle East is that both sides, because, again, of the fact of British and French dominance in that area, both sides were very actively solicited, and in fact themselves solicited in turn, by and to the fascists, if that sentence makes sense. We mentioned about, you know, Begin and Shamir being trained by Mussolini's fascists, about von Bolschwing making contacts with the Haganah. We read many months ago about a Jew who was being smuggled into Palestine, who found himself in the same safe houses with the SS men who were being smuggled out of Europe into South America. So it's a very complex thing to try and pin down, but I hope that this has been at least some help.
Oh, yeah, sure. Great. Okay, well, thanks a lot. If you feel inclined to do a program on it, I would certainly be interested.
Well, we're going to do a Radio Free America in the future to sum up the whole Olympics thing, because that's really a big subject in and of itself. But do stay tuned. We have other programs here on this station that we'll tell you about. And in particular, there's a summary of a recent Hard Rain series, a summary broadcast, which will outline, at the very least, some of these connections for you.
Okay, great. Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks again for your call. Okay, 415-941-2500. We've got a couple of lines open, so don't hesitate to call. And good evening, Berkeley. Welcome to KFJC.
Well, hello. Given Dave's little joke about a phone call and a half ago about Schultz and Weinberger and whatnot, I thought maybe perhaps you could dig up a copy of the Chad Mitchell Trio doing the I Was Not a Nazi Polka.
We've got that. I have that at home on a cassette. We'll see if we can do that maybe in another broadcast.
Great. I was wondering if either of you had ever run across a copy of a book entitled The Service, written by Reinhard Galen, supposedly his memoirs.
Yeah, I've got a copy of it. It's if it were printed on softer paper, it would be useful.
You know? Okay, so, and it isn't that useful. Okay.
Well, it I shouldn't say that. It's useful in the sense that it does give some interesting insights into Galen's character. In fact, in talking about Israel, he said he thought it was always too bad that West Germany got itself affiliated with Israel because of the Arab sympathies for Germany, and he didn't say Nazism, but he said Germany, and Nip referred to those sympathies earlier in the broadcast. So it does give some interesting insight into Galen's character, and to a certain extent into some of his methodology, but it's also filled with notorious lies, such as that Martin Bormann was a Soviet spy.
Yes, indeed. That was basically my only real question, because I sort of, well, I'll tell you the circumstances later on some other time, but it's just sort of was cited as a bibliography that I had in here for something that I picked up on the street, more or less.
Well, it's always worth looking at, if nothing else, than to be able to look at something like that, no matter how full of self-justifications, etc. It's like reading Richard Nixon's books. You know, I mean, it's fascinating, if nothing else, from sort of a psycho-historical point of view, although you might not want to put a lot of credence in anything.
Or putting Kissinger back-to-back with Seymour Hersh.
Indeed, indeed. Wonderful pair.
Okay, I'll make this brief and say good night.
Okay, good to hear from you.
Thank you very much for the wonderful job you're doing.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, back to the phones again. 415-941-2500 is the number with the line open. Good evening, San Carlos. Welcome to Radio Free America on KFJC.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment and find out what you think about it. It seems that the United States, or certain individuals in the Pentagon and the government and the private sector of the United States and Western nations, decided to protect the Nazis for their, their interest as, they seem to be motivated through greed and lust for power at any cost, whether it's an entire group of people or a planetary biosphere. Do you think that's accurate?
Well, it's awfully difficult to spread that kind of generalization around. I mean, honestly, and I think that this is true, I'm sure that there were some people involved in these activities immediately at the end of World War II who literally were behaving in what they felt were the most, patriotic, commendable possible way, and really felt communism is the worst thing that could happen in the world to the United States, the greatest country in the world, and any means are worth using to defend it. Literally any means. And, people who would have gone to their graves convinced that they had never done anything that wasn't in pursuit of the Holy Grail, of freedom and democracy. So, obviously, some of the people were not like, some of the people were just plain power hungry, as you said, or, just born manipulators or whatever the case may be. But I would hesitate to spread, a too thin a generalization on that.
It seems interesting that, how could you say, or how could you even conceive that communism would be worse than mass murderers of the heinous type that the Nazis are.
Well, it's like the neutron bomb, The neutron bomb just destroys people. It doesn't kill property, It's a question of where your priorities are. No, I have, honest to goodness, I did One Step Beyond, but when I used to be on another radio station in the morning with another co-host who started here with me at KFJC, this subject came up, and the gentleman involved, Tony Onisco, who I worked with for a long time, is a very honorable, good person, but he was basically saying that same thing. Anything is worth stopping communism, I don't think he quite understood the gravity of what we were talking about, but I mean, still, that impulse is there. So, you have to admit that it's real. You may not agree with it.
Yeah, that would appear to me to be quite criminal, and you destroy the fundamental principles which you're supposed to be supporting. I guess democracy and the pursuit of freedom, liberty and justice, and I guess more importantly, it would seem to me, obviously, at least to me, that and I guess there's some other people that it would usurp the basic principles of life-enhancing, life-supportive, cooperative behavior, and at the possible, or it seems so, at the destruction of humanity and all life on the planet. I mean, that seems where we're going now.
Well, we're certainly headed in that direction. In response to your first question or first comment, caller, there are different people. First of all, there were a lot of people who didn't know about employing these Nazis, and even including those, as we try to indicate, in our own intelligence system, various aspects of U.S. intelligence were reporting the alarming alarming incorporation, the operation of these Nazi war criminals with impunity, seemingly right under the noses of the Americans, reporting this to their superiors at the same time as these reports were filtering up to the very superiors who were in fact operating and pulling the strings of these various agents. So you have varying motivations, certainly both with the major industrialists who had been pro-Nazi during the war and whose connections we talked about in our Uncle Sam and the Swastika broadcast, and with the so-called small fry fascists who our first caller talked about and that are covered in that book Undercover. They were pro-Nazi, and certainly there were a few things that they would have enjoyed more than seeing these Nazis brought back to the United States. That fellow John Roy Carlson, or Arthur Darunian as his real name is, he wrote a book, a sequel volume to Undercover called The Plotters, which documented the post-war activities of many of these very same pro-Nazi elements and their functioning with elements abroad. So those are a couple things to think about in that context.
Okay, I just wanted to hear more of a moral conclusion from you guys more often, because it seems like I've got a lot of these tapes, and when I try to tell somebody else Or when somebody else, well, I got all these tapes, and they, you have, you know, 30 hours of tapes, so what? There's all this information, though. Just what does it all mean? It all means that it seems to me that the don't protect, I guess, mass murderers and criminals and heinous individuals.
Since you bring it up, caller, since you are looking for some kind of a moral conclusion, by and large, obviously, we try and avoid getting too personal, and although we wouldn't do it if we weren't personally involved. I mean, obviously, if it didn't mean something to us, we wouldn't be doing it in the first place.
Yeah.
But to address the issue very briefly, and I think probably the simplest form possible that you can kind of slap on as a fairly consistent moral throughout the whole thing, I think the point of what we're doing, briefly, is that before, okay, because the whole thing of anti-Americanism on, you know, that's slapped on this kind of work and this kind of journalism just falls out the window. The point of what we're doing is Americanism. What we're saying is that before the United States can become the kind of country that it wants to think that it is, we had better realize that at many times, in many places, and currently, right now, we are often the bad guy, not the good guy. And until we do that, and until we give up this incredible blindness about these things as a culture, you know, we're doomed. We are writing our own epitaph. And I think that's basically the moral that underlies the whole thing.
I think, caller, it could be summed up very could be summed up by a neat little phrase that was turned by John Donne, the British English poet, several hundred years ago, when he said, "He would lie with the dogs must rise with the fleas." Along those lines, the different elements of fascism have different motives. They're all anti-communist. My experience from my studies of the Third Reich is that for German National Socialism, for Nazism, anti-communism is as much of a means as it is an end. They are certainly anti-communist and devoted to eradicating communism or socialism in all of its forms, but anti-communism for them is also a very important MO, a modus operandi, through which they are able to infiltrate many organizations by representing them themselves, and very accurately so, as anti-communists, because the German Nazis themselves stemmed from a pan-German occult group called the Secret Order of Thule, which retained very strong influence, particularly upon the SS, and they believed that the Germans were a master race destined to rule the world. So when you invite these people in, you know, when you lie with the dogs, you rise with the fleas, and I think that's one of the reasons why we're finding ourselves scratching so much today.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. All right, back to the phone, to the line open at 415-941-2500. Good evening, Palo Alto. Welcome to KFJC and Radio Free America.
Hello.
Hello.
I just have one little tidbit of information, then two questions. One of them is getting back to Elmer Bobst, someone who I have a particular interest in. His first wife was Ethel Rose from the steel conglomerate in Pittsburgh. She later helped. She is directly related to the Mudge Rose and Nixon law firm, which Nixon originally got started in. Just a little bit of trivia there.
That's quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Another thing, I have a question. I'm very interested in Klaus von Bülow. Does he fit into any of this? Has he any kind of a connection?
It's that old Prussian von, right?
Changing of the names and all this stuff.
His father was a documented Nazi in Sweden, I believe it was, and affiliations, I've forgotten the father's name, his Nazi affiliations are well known. Von Bülow himself is an interesting fellow. Three of his jurors were from the, I've forgotten what the name is, something like School of Naval and I've forgotten its exact name, but a very prominent naval intelligence institution from Providence, Rhode Island, which is interesting when you're getting a random selection of jurors. His defense attorney is the same defense attorney that Edwin Wilson had, a guy named Harold Price Faringer. So it's interesting. And there was a von Bülow family very, very closely affiliated with the Krupp Industrial Empire in Germany and its affiliations with the German conquest, both during World War II and before that, are very well known.
Well, didn't he change his name? Wasn't it something like Annenberg or something like that previously?
I don't remember. He may have changed his name. The father's name was not von Bülow, at least as far as we know. I've forgotten what his name was, but he was a Nazi. He was pro-Nazi, and I've forgotten what kind of an end he met.
Because he changed his name to von Bülow. He named his daughter Cosima, which is Cosima von Bülow was the name of the wife of Richard Wagner. Kind of an interesting choice.
That's right. That's true. That is correct. You know, back on the subject also, the earlier question about Nixon's law firm. Now, Dave, I'm going to have to get you at least a nod or a head shake from you on this. Was this that, now, the law firm was, what was the name caller at that time?
Rose and Nixon.
Okay. Now, was that at the same law firm that was later used as the Western Tube Front?
No, that was Bewley, Krupp, and Nixon.
That's what I thought, okay.
This was one that he was affiliated with. Interestingly enough, though, that law firm did a lot of legal work for the Sindona Empire.
Right,
McCabe-Sindona.
It's just interesting that Nixon, one of his law firms, then being the instrument to introduce Nikolai Mlox, a prominent Iron Guard financier, into the country, and another law institute being at least in some way, shape, or form, however distantly, connected to Elmer Bobst, an intimate apparently of Otto von Bolschwing. So,
well, I know that Warner Lambert did extensive dealings with the Nazis during World War II, and also World War I was apparently where they claimed to have made most of their of the fortune, so it's some ongoing thing.
Right.
And I have one other question, something that's beginning to interest me more and more.
Before we get to that caller, note that all of the pharmaceutical industries worldwide have a very close traditional association with the IG Farben and Nazi conglomerate, so that's something to keep in mind, too.
Oh, another little bit of gossip here. Elmer Bobst's son, named Walton, tried to start his own pharmaceutical company in Switzerland during the 1950s, and it is reputed that he was assassinated by his father, but I don't have any documented information on that. This is all hearsay. But
the blood is thicker than the water, obviously.
Yeah, well, remember what John Donne said, you know.
That's right.
My question is that I know from my readings of history, now they maybe have been tainted or whatever, but there was a big grab bag of Nazis at the end of World War II. The Russians also try to get their share of whatever the was up for the grabs. What do you know about Nazis who later became prominent within the Soviet Union after supposedly putting on different uniforms also? This has to do with the idea of possibly a sort of a Odessa conspiracy or something to get the two world powers into a cataclysmic war in which they would both be obliterated, and then the Fourth Reich could reassert itself.
You should have heard the conversation we had before the radio show tonight, because it deals very much with this kind of stuff.
We were talking about some of the Byzantine connections. Yeah, two good books to look for, caller. Again, the Skorzeny, subtitled Hitler's Commando by Glenn Infield, talks at some length about Odessa and SS contingents that were working, at least to all appearances, for the Soviets. Another book also by Glenn Infield. As a matter of fact, there's a paperback at it. The Skorzeny book is kind of hard to find, but you look around, be resourceful, and you can check it out. And like I said, we're going to give you an address at the end of the broadcast where we'll talk about that. Maybe you can find that book. But there's another book by Glenn Infield called Secrets of the SS, and there's a recent paperback edition which some people have seen around in stores. And that talks about also some SS men who went to work for the Soviet intelligence system. Specifically, there's a reference there to something called the SSD, the Staatssicherheitsdienst, which was an SS contingent put together by Soviet bloc intelligence, specifically East German intelligence, for the purpose of infiltrating the SS, the huge SS contingent within the Galen organization. And they, among other things, were successful in spiriting out all of the documents of the Wannsee Institute, which, among other things, was in charge of all Sicherheitsdienst intelligence against SS intelligence against Russia, and that was headed up by by Akhmatelli and Augsburg of Green Berets that we talked about before. Infield in Skorzeny, Hitler's Commando, talks at some length about SS men being used by the Soviet system and about these really sort of Byzantine counter-espionage conspiracies. Exactly, Which SS guys working for which side and where their real allegiances lie is a subject of real hot debate. There's a tremendously incestuous relationship. Galen's chief of counterintelligence for a long time was a guy named Heinz Felfa, and he turned out to be KGB eventually. And when I was guesting for Nip Tuck on One Step Beyond last Sunday, I said, and I can't speak for Nip here, I'll get his comment, I guess, in a sec. I don't deal, at least on air, that much with counter-espionage. In other words, KGB head-to-head with CIA or other opposing intelligence services, because really, about the only thing you know for sure is that you're not going to get the truth from either side. There is some historical documentation for SS men working for the Russians. Plus, you recall in Radio Free America, all of the Third Reich police apparatus was part of the RSHA, the Reichssicherheitshauptamt, and you had that the RSHA basically consisted of the SD, the SS Intelligence Service, plus something called the SIPO, which not only involved the Gestapo, but also the Kriminalpolizei as well. So all any German post-World War II German with real police experience would have been nominal, at least, a member of the SS. And so certainly, given the relatively sparse population and the extent to which all of the Eastern countries were hard put to come up with requisite people to serve in their various institutions, I'd be willing to bet, and there's considerable evidence, that there are a fair number of Nazi police veterans working in various police capacities in East Germany.
As I understand it, I think that the space program also in both countries borrowed heavily from sort of a split down the middle of kind of rivalries within the German rocket program. Am I incorrect on that, or do you know anything about that?
Yeah. Good book to check that out is Project Paperclip, by Clarence Lasby. Talks about that at some length. Athenium Press is publishers. So see if you can dig that one up. That talks about that at some length. Yeah, there was hot competition to grab as many of the experts as they could.
Applying to nuclear weapons.
I would suggest very briefly, just two quick points, caller. One, on the subject of the rocket scientists, I would say that if in any cases that there was a case where some people honestly did not go to one side or the other because of political preferences, it would have been among the rocketry experts, although certainly a lot of the rocketry experts were very profoundly pro-Nazi, and von Braun and Dornberger's background is talked about at some length in Operation Paperclip, Project Paperclip. But I would say also there's probably a possibility that some of the scientists merely just went with whoever wound up with them without any particular ideological thing. On the other end, in answer to your first question, I generally agree with Dave on the subject of SS and counterintelligence and KGB, etc. The only thing I would suggest is that in the march on Berlin, I would say that fewer of the German SS people and people of that nature would have gone over to the Russians, as opposed to, say, if the Russians had gone into Italy, it probably would have been split about 50-50 as to what side people wound up on. Whereas the Germans, and specifically the SS, had such a profound hatred of Bolshevism and of the communist system that I think that a lot of them probably would just not have done it. For what, you know, however they would have gotten out of it, they just would not have gone and, you know, would not have been able to fit into that system, because we're talking about a real indoctrination, to the point of blood ritual and things like that.
Sure, but what interests me is the possibility of a collusion, of a deliberate infiltration of the Soviet Union with long-term goals in mind.
Everything is possible in the world of counterintelligence.
Both, yeah, the Soviet intelligence system has, you know, been pretty heavily penetrated by Galen agents of all stripe, you know, Eastern European Solidarists and so forth. And in turn, they've been very successful in penetrating Galen. So, you know,
who knows?
Again, it's a very Byzantine connection, and you really don't know. You know, all we can do is speculate, and one of the things we try to do with our hard documentary format is to try and stick to what we can really, you know, document. There is massive infiltration by both Galen into the KGB, Soviet Warsaw Pact intelligence, and vice versa. Exactly, you know. Who's controlling whom? I think probably both sides would really like to know, you know?
Indeed.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks again for the call.
Goodbye.
I might mention, too, real quickly, that one of the things Dave and I were talking about before the show started tonight is that when we do get to the Radio Free Americas we're going to do on the assassination of the Pope, we're going to be talking, among other things, about the Bulgarian connections and things of that nature, which deal exactly with this kind of stuff that the caller has been talking about. However, we're going to, again, try and limit it to pretty much stuff that we can document at that point. Anyway, going back to the phones with the line open at 415-941-2500. Good evening, San Jose. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to Radio Free America.
Yes, good evening. I had a couple of questions and some comments. I really enjoyed your show.
Thank you.
It's not over yet. Stay tuned.
Yeah, and I continue to. The first one is you brought up some points about the CIA and the Odessa Network basically establishing the Egyptian Secret Service and being influential in establishing the PLO.
The first Palestinian terrorists, I don't know if we can equate that with the PLO,
that
which is a political organization.
That was my mistake. I stuck those two terms together in summing something up, and one should not necessarily do that.
Okay, well, in any event, having a great influence establishing the Egyptian Secret Service, ostensibly to work against the interest of Israel and the state of Israel.
Right.
And then on the other hand, you know, how do you... if you have a contradiction, which I see here, because you have the CIA also establishing and financing and arming the Zionist fascist state of Israel on the, you know, on one side, and then you have the Egyptian Secret Service on the other, and you also mentioned Syria. I was in and out, so I didn't catch it all. But you didn't really seem to deal with that contradiction. Why would the U.S. or the imperialist powers of the West go about financing these opposing forces like that?
Okay, first of all, a couple of questions. First of all, I just want to take a slight bit of exception with the term Zionist fascist government of Israel, the early days is hard to tell because that was coming out of the revolutionary ferment of the post-war era in the Middle East. But certainly in much of the later part of the Israeli government, I wouldn't use that term. I come close to that term with the Begin government and parts of the Shamir government, but it's just a term I'm a little uncomfortable with. To address your point specifically, well, one of the reasons, as was mentioned in the article from the Cookridge book, rather, that one of the reasons that they sent the Nazis to Egypt to set up the Secret Service was precisely because of the CIA's direct contacts with Israel. Now, why they would allow them to do it is because primarily they were not supporting Egypt to attack Israel.